Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 15, take three. I'm Karen, and as always, I'm joined by Kristen.
Hi, everyone.
I should say not like an entire episode take three. It's we had two false starts in the beginning, and now I'm hoping that we're on track.
Some technical difficulties, some brain difficulties, but we're here.
Yeah. Once again, socially distanced.
Yes. And this time it is absolutely my fault. Not COVID as far as I know so far. My at-home test was negative, but I still have like a fever and I'm feeling kind of weird. So we decided it would be safest to just keep our distance, so Karen doesn't necessarily have to catch whatever the heck I have.
Yeah, that would be ideal.
Yeah, no, nobody else needs to be sick.
Can't be too safe these days. So
yeah,
here we are. And I'm sure this is not going to be the last time. So
probably not, sadly.
Just have to stick to it. But if you guys want to contact us, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and at Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. Today, we're going to be talking about Dragon Pearl by Yoon Ha Lee, very exciting, plus The Initiation, which is the short story in Cursed Carnival. There will be some spoilers, but they'll be at the end, and I will tell you when they are coming. So
And if you want zero spoilers, go read the book and then listen to this episode.
Yes.
Because that's really the only way you can avoid all of them.
Yeah. And I mean, if you've avoided spoilers at this point, I mean, that book is like 3 years old. So good for you. Okay, let's jump into our news and updates this week. We actually don't have too many, but January 13th was Magnus Chase's birthday. So happy birthday, Magnus.
Happy birthday. Yeah. I mean, hi. Happy birthday, man.
Kind of bummed. Missed this on Twitter, but you know.
It's okay. You won't hit everything. Yep. You're going to miss something occasionally.
So we also heard from Becky this week. Not like she never tweets. She tweets like every day. That was a weird transition, but at this point, I'm just going with it. So somebody asked Becky if there was a PJO TV update, and she said, not yet, still working on stuff. Secret stuff, winky face. So that was secret nice. Stuff. No idea what that means, but I don't even care. I'm just happy that she said there's stuff. So
I would guess, because they've been accepting people's audition videos, so I would bet they're going through those and probably still working on script stuff, maybe starting to get the first bits of like design, like for the show. Like I'd imagine it's stuff like that, that they're starting to kind of get together. But
I would even love just like an official logo or title, you know, something like that. That would be really cool.
Or an official green light.
I mean, yeah, like,
you know,
I was trying to be realistic, but also yes.
Yes. Also that would be a great Valentine's Day gift from Disney to us. So, you know,
yes, it would.
That in mind, Disney Plus.
Reminder that Reclaim the Stars comes out on February 15th. This is a short story anthology. You can pre-order it right now, and I'll be sure to include the link in our show notes. It features young adult stories about forbidden love, broken promises, and monsters long misunderstood. And it includes short stories from Kwame Mbalia, Mark Oshiro, and Rebecca Roanhorse, among many other cool people.
Which is just awesome.
Yes, this is on my review list to write about for Subjectify Media. So there probably will be a full review on Subjectify about this book. And then I might just give you guys an update after I've read the stories to tell you how awesome they are, because I assume they're going to be awesome.
That sounds like a very nice plan.
Okay, so we're jumping right into Dragon Pearl this week. I was pretty excited about this. I reread the book because I read it when it first came out. And I mean, I remembered like the big stuff, but I wanted to kind of get back into the world before I read Tiger Honor. And I was really glad I did, because the books are a lot more closely linked together than I thought they were. So it was nice to just like go from one to the other. But Kristen, this was your very first time reading it.
Yes, it was. And I listened to basically the first half, maybe a little bit further than that. Listened to it on the audiobook, which I really did enjoy, narrated by Kim, my guest. And I really, really liked it. It's really good. I think I've listened to things narrated by her before, because the name is kind of familiar and the voice was very familiar to me. And she's really, really good at the whole thing. So highly recommend if you're an audiobook listener. And then I finished it the last half, a little less than half, reading via ebook, because I knew that if I listened to it the whole way through, I would have a hard time differentiating and recognizing the names of all the characters. That's one of the downsides of the audiobook, is you don't see the characters' names as they come up. And sometimes if names are really similar or like have, you know, a lot of the same prefixes or things, I've had this happen with Jennifer Armentrout's Greek series too. One of her Greek fantasy series, I could not keep names straight at all. So I ended up having to go in and read some of it just to kind of get all the names down. And then I was like, okay. But I think that helped me a lot, because now I think I have a better grasp of it. But
yeah. And I read the book the whole way through. I didn't get the audio version, which means that I was pronouncing a lot of the characters' names wrong in my head, but luckily Yoon puts the pronunciation guide at the end of the book. And I love when authors do this. Rick has done this in the past with a lot of like the Greek stuff. And I'm just obsessed with like pronunciation guides. And I go through every one and like say it out loud and try to get used to it. And that was very, it's going to be very helpful for these two books that we're going to be doing when we do Tiger Honor as well, because, you know, I don't know how to pronounce a lot of these names, and it was a huge, huge help.
Oh yeah, for sure. I remember the Hermione debacle.
Yeah.
When Americans were like, what is this weird sounding foreign name? Like Hermione and yeah. all this stuff. So yeah, we all had our own problems. So yeah, I really, really appreciate this too, because it lets you get it right rather than like completely screwing it up in discussions from here on forever. Like, you have a place to kind of go back to it too. If you own the book, or if you, you know, rent the book, you know where to find the pronunciations. So it helps a lot.
Right. So we're going to be talking about the book in like fairly general terms. Basically, we're going to go through the characters and talk about how we feel about them, and that'll kind of bring out the plot a little bit. And then once we get into spoiler territory, I'll have a clear marker for that. But to start us off, basically the general plot of the book, if it's been a while since you've read it or you hadn't read it yet, is Mean's brother is branded as a traitor for defecting in search of the Dragon Pearl, which can terraform or destroy entire worlds. So she sneaks off planet and impersonates a dead soldier in order to find answers. This entire book is basically sci-fi meets Korean folklore. And I have to tell you, I am super into it. There was an arc on Teen Wolf about fox spirits, the Kitsune and the Nagitsune, and that is my favorite season of the show. A lot of people love that season of the show, and it was obviously, in my uneducated opinion, very well done. But I do think that like Jeff and the whole team did their research on all of that. And I've just kind of been enamored with the idea of fox spirits since then. And when I heard that this book was coming out, I got really excited, because I also love sci-fi, and blending the two together, you don't really see that too often. At least like I haven't come across a lot of books like that. So for me, it was like a really unique take on two things that I already love, set in a world and about a culture that I don't know a whole lot about. So it was like a really good learning opportunity for me as well. What did you think, Kristen, when you first kind of dipped a toe into Dragon Pearl?
I don't read a lot of sci-fi. I watch a lot of sci-fi movies, but I don't read a lot of sci-fi books. And I think it's because sometimes some of the science is a little hard for me to wrap my brain around reading it all. Like if I see you know, the Martian, like if I see the ship in space revolving around itself to create its own gravity. And then I see the little, you know, extra things going down to Mars, and I can picture it better. But I think when I read sometimes with sci-fi, I have trouble kind of grasping all of the science of it all. So it's it's not my forte, but I didn't have too much trouble picturing what was going on in these books. There wasn't so much like crazy complicated machinery or anything going on. So I didn't really have a lot of trouble with that. And I, like you, I do love a good folklore. I mean, we're Rick Riordan fans, so you know, you kind of have to be. It goes with the territory. I love some folklore, Korean folklore. Again, I've watched Teen Wolf at Karen's behest, at Karen's invitation. I don't even know. I've watched Teen Wolf, and I really also loved that season, and it kind of got me into the whole Kitsune thing and learning more about it. So this was a lot of fun for that reason, especially. Generally very interested. Especially once I got started, I wanted to see where this was going.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think that you have a really good point in terms of the sci-fi, because sci-fi can be like high fantasy for me, that if it's like really deep, intense sci-fi, then I also get a little lost. Thankfully, like this is technically a middle grade book, but we were discussing just the other day, doesn't necessarily feel like middle grade. It feels a little bit like YA because Mean pretends to be 16 years old, and there's really nothing in there that's like super silly or like, I don't want to say dumbed down, because I don't think middle grade is like a dumbed down version of YA, but something like more simplistic. I think that it carries some really heavy themes and consequences for people's actions. And so sometimes it kind of shifted a little bit into like that YA sphere for me.
Yeah. I don't have a ton of experience with middle grade. Like most of it is reading Rick's books, let's be honest. His take is how I've kind of imagined most middle grade kind of sets itself apart from YA, because you're right. Like with a younger audience, you kind of want to dumb down some of the, not dumb down. I know what you mean. you kind of want to like take the edge off the consequences for things. And this didn't, you know, as right. Min goes on, it's exactly what you imagine the consequences would be if this were a regular sci-fi movie. Like if it was a PG-13 sci-fi movie, I don't think they'd have to change much. And so that does, I agree with you there, where it felt kind of YA for me. And again, it may be because Min was playing older than she is, so she wasn't really settled into her 13-year-old, you know, mindset and all of that, but it's still a really great story, so.
Yeah, definitely. So let's jump into the characters now, and I guess we should start with Min because that makes the most sense. She is a fox spirit, and fox spirits have the ability to charm people. They have the ability to shapeshift. They have enhanced smell. She also particularly is good with machines as well. And I thought that the shapeshifting part is always really cool in stories. There's so much you can do with that. And it's not like she just shapeshifts into like animals or anything. She can shapeshift into a table. That opening scene with her pretending to be the table is like something that really stuck in my mind from a couple of years ago when I read it. And charm obviously has its place there too. So she's kind of got this like whole arsenal of abilities that really help her get away with, you know, getting off planet and sneaking into the space forces and all of that.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think the shapeshifting into inanimate objects thing is so interesting. Like at one point in the book, no spoilers, she kind of contemplates shapeshifting into an inanimate object to save oxygen. And I'm like, wait, so she doesn't have to breathe when she's a table? Like, that's so weird, you know? Like, you don't think about that, but it's just crazy.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of logistics, I guess, that you wouldn't necessarily think of with this sort of thing that makes sense if you actually sit down and go, okay, how would this work on a, like, molecular level? Which is not necessarily something that I was, you know, thinking about all of the time. But yeah, it's a really good point. And it's just interesting how she chooses to use her abilities too.
Definitely.
Because we find out very early on, Mina's kind of a troublemaker. She comes from a poor planet and kind of, you know, she doesn't get along with her aunts a whole lot. And she has some issues with her cousins, and she's just, you know, Fox spirits anyway, in this book and elsewhere, tend to be tricksters. So not a lot of people trust them. And Mean's family is trying to do good and be better for the sake of their species. But Mean is good at getting in trouble. And it's one of the things that I really like about her, because it reminds me a bit of Percy, reminds me a bit of Aru Shah, probably even more, in that, you know, she means well, but she just can't help herself sometimes.
It's kind of like Leo, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit.
She's got some Leo Valdez in her.
Yeah, for sure. And I really like how she kind of wings it through the space forces. This is essentially like a military, we were discussing this too, like kind of like a military school kind of thing. There are some very young kids that are able to get into the space forces, and they go through training on a ship out in space, and it's regimented like the military would be. And she just kind of slips her way inside thanks to her abilities. And she just kind of on the fly figures out how to do everything and becomes a really good cadet at the same time. So I kind of love that aspect too.
Yeah. I think Space Force, the best parallel would be Star Trek and the Federation, mm-hmm. because yep. it's kind of military, like in the way it handles rank and just like daily chores and all of that stuff. But it's also more about exploration and about like that sort of thing rather than like doing battle against right. others. Like, it doesn't seem like their first job is, you know, fighting or whatever. Their first job is to be explorers and to help people and whatever, but they do have the ability to defend themselves in a, you know, in case of needing to or whatever. But yeah, she's definitely good at getting herself into, and I will say out of, a pinch, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In terms of it being kind of militaristic, that's why it's such a big deal that her brother supposedly defected. She, you know, an inspector comes to their house and kind of explains the situation that it looks like he defected in search of the Dragon Pearl to try to find this artifact that a lot of people at this point in time don't believe actually exists. And that he's, you know, gone off to grab that and make some money off of it. And she doesn't believe it. I don't think her mom believes it, but all signs kind of point to him doing that. And it's a really big deal. And this is what inspires her to try to go off planet, prove his innocence, and live her dreams of being part of the space forces and getting out into the rest of the universe to see what's out there.
Yeah. Again, when we kind of briefly talked earlier this week while I was still halfway through the book, so I didn't even know everything at that point. we kind of talked about how this reminded me a little of Daughter of the Deep.
Mm-hmm.
Not that in Daughter of the Deep, Anna was trying to save her brother, but in her trying to kind of avenge him and, like, you know, was kind of doing it for him because she thought he was dead and she was, you know, still grieving her parents and all of that. It kind of gave me that similar vibe, you know, girl going off into the unknown, trying to avenge or save her brother. Like, it just gave me
that. I just started seeing Frozen.
Into the end. Yeah, no, yeah. For sure. But yeah, it just gave me that feeling, that same impression. And I loved Daughter of the Deep. So I was like, okay, all right, I can get on board here. Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the way that she talks about June, her brother, is really, I liked their relationship. I liked how she looked up to him. It reminded me like a little bit of Hiro and Tadashi from Big Hiro 6. That's kind of what I kept imagining. I know. So you're kind of looking forward to meeting him in the book and figuring out what's going on, because like her, you don't want to believe that he defected either. But we'll discuss more of that at the end in the spoiler section. I don't want to get into too much of that right now, but the next big character I do want to talk about is very closely tied to Mean, because it's Jang, who was a human who tried, like him and his team tried to rescue her from some people that were attacking her on the ship she was on, and he ended up getting killed. And this happens in the beginning of the book, so it's not like, you know, a major shock or anything. But he was human, now he's dead, but he's a spirit. And this was another aspect of the book I really liked, is how spirits are talked about and kind of what it means within this culture and for a lot of these characters, because spirits can cause bad luck and they're not really to be trusted, not necessarily because they're evil, but they really only care about like revenge and fulfilling their purpose so that they can move on. So they can kind of be troublemakers too, just like Mean. And I feel like we didn't get a ton of Jang's personality necessarily, but I thought it was really interesting how Mean assumes his identity in order to sneak onto this ship and infiltrate the ship that her brother was on to find out what was going on. And she now has to interact with his friends as Jang, and it's just really interesting how she kind of, again, wings it and pulls it off. And people don't, like, they think she's kind of weird at first, but they chalk it up to, oh, it was a head injury, or like, you've been really confused since you woke up in the infirmary, and we're just kind of dealing with that, but like, everything's fine. But this constant need to make sure she's not caught, not only like on the ship, but just that she has to prove that she's Jang the whole time, really adds to the suspense and tension of the story.
For sure. Yeah. Plus, she's also trying to keep concealed her powers and yet has to use them time and time and time again, because the only way for her to continue to A, appear as Jang, and also like keep moving forward and, you know, continue to get answers for herself and for him and all of that. Yeah. It's odd that the first time we meet Jang, he's already dead.
Right?
Like, yeah. We don't meet him when he's alive. We meet him when he's dead. And then we hear about what happened from him. And so that is a very unique situation.
It is. And how they describe spirits is really interesting, too, because no matter what they looked like in life, in death, they usually have, like, very long hair. And I can't remember if there was something about, like, their teeth or their eyes or something, where it was like, they definitely didn't just look like themselves when they were alive. And then their legs kind of disappear into nothingness while the rest of them is like kind of translucent, I think. So I thought that was really interesting.
And I believe there's also usually some signifier of how they died, depending on the ghost. Okay. It changes. Cause I think, I don't remember Zhang's, because I don't entirely remember when we first met him, how she described him, but later on in the story, we get a description of another ghost. And I remember her talking about seeing like specific things that revolved around how, you know, that person died in the world. So okay. I think that sometimes, especially if it's like a particularly violent death, maybe if it's something that could show on their person, then you can see it. We'll get more into this when I can talk freely.
Yeah.
Because I'm stumbling, trying not to say any things that, you know, cross the spoiler line.
Right.
But I don't think this qualifies as a spoiler, because this happens right away when she meets Zhang. Rather than just pretending to be Zhang, she asks permission.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I really loved that because... she's alive and she could have just done it. Like, she could have just been like, yeah, I'm doing this. Sorry, you know, what's Zhang really, what can he really do to stop her? But she really would not have done it if he hadn't given her permission. She would have figured out another way or, you know, done something else. Mm-hmm. So I really loved that she asked his permission and kind of bartered with him to have permission to be him, because I think that just makes it feel that much better.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, you know, to be honest, probably a large part of that was the fact that he can bring bad luck, so she didn't want to make him angry. But I definitely think there's an element of just plain old respect there. Mm-hmm. And knowing that this is going to be difficult for Zhang, that he's still, you know, dead and trying to deal with that. It wasn't that long ago he died, and now all of a sudden she's like, hey, can I use your body? Like, can I pretend to be you? And that's going to be very difficult for him. So yeah, I completely agree. I think that's really interesting. And the trade-off there is that, you know, she's going to look into his death. And that's another element of the story that she has to kind of tiptoe around throughout the book. There are a lot of pieces that are constantly kind of rotating, and you're waiting for them to sink down into the right spot. And I find that element of the story really interesting, because like you said, it really makes you want to get to the end. Like, I think Dragon Pearl is an interesting book in that there is plenty of action, but a lot of it is also just you being inside Mean's head and her trying to tiptoe around everything. And that can be suspenseful, but also a little slow sometimes as you're trying to investigate what is happening. But because you have so many questions, it constantly drives the story forward.
I do agree with you there. I had some moments throughout the story where it felt like it was a little slow, maybe dragging a little bit. It was taking a little too long to move on to the next obstacle. And I 100% agree. You're supposed to, you know, be taking this time to really get to know Mean and be in her head and see how she manages to get through these, you know, obstacles put in front of her time and time again. And, you know, it doesn't hurt the story that it gets a little slow. If anything, it helps it when it picks up near the end. It really helps it to feel like it's speeding along, because it does happen really fast. But yeah, it does have some moments where it kind of pulls back a little bit and gives you some time.
Mm-hmm. I think part of that too is we also have to get used to these other characters in the books, just like Mean does. Mean is meeting some new people for the first time, and she has to pretend to be friends with them because they were Zhang's friends. And so we have two main characters there. You have Sujin and Hanul. Sujin goes by they, them, and they're a dogebi, which is a goblin. And a goblin in Korean mythology in this story has a horn in the center of their forehead, and Sujin has a magical spork that can summon snacks. And is there anything cooler than that?
I mean, and also useful. Let's be real, especially if you're in space. Right? Not having to worry about like getting some sort of nutrient. I mean, snacks may not be the best way to keep yourself fueled, but you're not going to go hungry. Like,
right.
As long as you have Sujin with you, you'll be fine.
And didn't they also summon like tea or something?
Well, I know. I think Sujin talks about it and says that they have trouble summoning like hardier things.
Right.
I don't necessarily think it's because Sujin was weak or anything. It may just take practice.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's not, you know, Sujin was always like, snacks are good. All I need are snacks. But like maybe with more practice and working on it, they could summon something a little more substantial if necessary. But I don't know.
Yeah, I thought Sujin was really interesting and just like a different kind of character. And then you also had Hanul, who goes by she, her, and she is a dragon spirit who can control the weather and generate electricity. I'm not saying anything bad about fox spirits, but a dragon spirit, really? Like, that is so cool.
Well, and both of them, Sujin and Hanul, can appear human.
Right.
Like, they both change their appearance just enough. You know, they can't shapeshift like Mean can into anything.
Right.
But they can change their appearance so that they don't necessarily stay in their spirit form all the time. So you're not looking at the goblin form of Sujin all the time. Sometimes you're seeing them as a human, especially in the Space Force. That becomes, you know, really helpful.
Mm-hmm. And Hanul can turn into an actual dragon, which is just the coolest ever.
I mean, who doesn't want a dragon as a friend? Especially they can control the weather. I'm sorry, but I would love to have a friend who could, you know, stop it raining just while we walk into a building or whatever, so I don't have to deal with wet pants and all that jazz.
Yeah.
And I love summer, so, you know, a sunny day, an extra sunny day every now and then would be nice.
Yeah. Now, remind me, at first, was it Hanul who was a little distant from Mean, right? Wasn't she a little bit harder to, like...
I believe so, yeah. Because Sujin is the... excited to just help and starts throwing snacks at people and is like, you know, let's get Zhang fed and, like, you know, let's help him out and all that. Like, yeah, I think Hanul was a little more conservative about it. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe we should make sure our friend's okay. I don't necessarily think Hanul was on to Mean, like thought it was someone else or anything,
right.
But was definitely a little on edge that Zhang wasn't quite acting like himself.
Right, exactly. I remember liking Sujin a lot and not really getting like a good read on Hanul at first, but then by the end of the book you kind of get a better picture of both of them and it really kind of fills in some of those gaps. So that was pretty cool. The last major character that I want to talk about is Captain Huan. He is a tiger spirit who has heightened senses, basically can tell when somebody is lying, superhuman strength, shape-shifting abilities into a tiger. And Yun does mention, like, tigers typically have, like, some anger issues as well. So Captain Huan is, at first, kind of a character you see from a distance and then starts getting some questions about Mean and who she is and what she's doing there. And I don't know how much more we can say until we hit our spoiler section.
Yeah, I think that's pretty safe.
Yeah, he was a scary dude at first, definitely somebody you respected and were very afraid of because you kind of could tell that he would, like, they can often detect charm and other magic like foxes can, which, by the way, foxes sneezing whenever like magic is used, I thought was really adorable. Right. I really liked that aspect, but like tiger spirits can also detect magic a lot more easily. So Mean, you know, she was already trying to be super, super careful. And now there's this added element. And I swear, like, as the book goes on, it just keeps adding and adding and adding to it. And you're like, what is the breaking point going to be?
Yeah. I think when I don't know if I read it wrong or if I just didn't quite grasp what Yun was trying to get across to us. I didn't see Captain Huan as that scary at first.
Really?
Like,
okay.
Like the tiger aspect of it was definitely meant to be intimidating. And I grasped that. But like when it came to Mean meeting him the first time, I thought it was more of like okay, this is the captain. I respect him. He's a tiger. That could be a problem, but okay. But like the general impression I got of him was that he was kind of not jokey, but like approachable maybe.
Oh, like, okay.
While intimidating, he was also not like so intimidating that nobody ever asked him anything. Because I had the unapproachable, like, scary thing came through his second in command. I can't remember their name. But it's, the one who every time Mean does anything wrong, that person is the one who yells at him.
Yeah.
So, like, that was my initial reaction to Huan. I didn't necessarily see him as like this, you know, imposing crazy, you know, force. So as the story moved on, as thing, you know, I kind of had to look deeper at the character, but mm-hmm. we can talk about that more when we get to, yeah. to the spoiler section. 'Cause yeah,
I definitely thought that he was, you know, the way that Mean kind of approaches him is a little bit careful, definitely respectful. I think my fear for her situation probably fed into how I pictured him. Also, I have to admit that even though he's a tiger spirit who's like literally looks like a person and then can change into a tiger, I pictured him with a tiger head the entire time. I'm so sorry to everybody, including Yoon-Ha Lee, but like it was the only way I could kind of keep him in my mind, like remembering that he was a tiger spirit, is like in my head, he's literally got a human body and a white tiger head stuck on top. And it just kind of works. I don't know, but
I was gonna say, did he look slightly like the tiger guy from Kung Fu Panda? Because
yes, when you said
that, I was like, oh, tiger head, like all of a sudden that was the visual that presented.
Oh my god, for me,
it was like that guy. I've only seen that movie once, and that's all. Yeah, still all I can think of. Anyway, that is kind of funny.
Kung Fu Fox,
maybe.
I was trying to come up with a good episode title. That one's going in the dustbin. No, I wanted to look up. Oh, Tigress, Master Tigress.
Oh yeah, that's it.
Yeah, wasn't there? Was the other, who was the bad guy in that movie? Wasn't it another tiger or no? This is so unimportant, but now I was going to say,
I do not remember. It has been a very long time since I saw that.
Kung Fu Panda, bad guy. Tai Lung, Snow Leopard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So similar. I mean, not the same. Definitely not the same creature, but.
But not super dissimilar. So.
Both white cats.
Yes. Anyway, that has nothing to do with Dragon Pearl.
It's all right. Sometimes tangents happen. We'll just keep moving on.
Okay, so that's the gist of the story and the characters. There's one more aspect of the book that I want to talk about in depth, and then we'll get into the spoiler section. And that is, this book is very, very LGBTQIA+ friendly. I absolutely love this aspect of the book. Pronouns, basically like having a tag on your shirt, your uniform, is commonplace. And they're a part of everyday life. Quite a few of the characters are non-binary, and we get even more in Tiger Honor, you know, go by they, them pronouns. And I really love this because, especially if you're in or tangential to the LGBTQ community, pronouns are being talked about more and more. And I think they're becoming more commonplace in our society. And I just really loved that it wasn't an issue in this book. It just existed. Nobody questioned it. Nobody disrespected anybody by not calling them the right pronouns, even if they didn't necessarily agree. Like, it was just a known thing that happened and everybody was totally fine with it.
I love that you're right. It's just not a thing. You know, you wear your tag when you go out in the world. And so then everybody knows with a glance how to address you. And that's just how it is. It's so easy.
Yeah.
It's so easy.
And that wasn't the only part of the book that I thought was really queer friendly too, because the thing that kind of surprised me was polyamory, because that's not talked about a whole lot. But there is a line in there where one of the prisoners said he lost his husbands. And I mean, I'm assuming it's polyamory and not like some other kind of situation. I don't know if that stuck out to you at all.
I remember the moment. I was still listening to the audiobook at that point, and I don't know if I caught that it was plural or I thought it was possessive, like husbands something or other.
Mm.
But it's very possible that it was worded like this. Again, I was listening to the audiobook, so I didn't actually get to see it in print. But yeah, I mean, I don't see any reason why Yoon wouldn't have included it, especially as, you know, a part of the world. Like, again, another accepted part of the world. This is just the universe Yoon has created includes polyamorous characters, and nobody needs to discuss the fact that this prisoner is talking about how they, you know, he lost his husbands. Like, that's just, right. You know, nobody's like, you know, acting ridiculous behind the scenes because they said that. Like, it's just, that's the reality of sexuality in that world that
It doesn't, like, this is the same thing with Star Trek and Star Wars and all of that. It doesn't make sense to have an entire universe of planets out there and, like, nobody's gay. You know what I mean? Or they don't identify in ways different than what we're used to in a heteronormative society. And the fact that this book is for children, it's a middle grade book, is huge, because there's going to be a lot of kids out there who are thinking about these sort of things, especially non-binary. And as we kind of, as a society, learn and understand more about gender and the spectrum that it's on, I think there are going to be a lot of kids who are going to find this book and really identify with some of these characters, especially when we get to Tiger Honor. And for me, just like setting that baseline early on to introduce kids to these sort of concepts makes it a whole lot easier to build on that later in life. They're getting a much bigger head start than, you know, I did when I was that age. I had no idea any of this kind of stuff existed. And that is probably one of my favorite things about this book.
I agree. Yeah, it's definitely giving kids a better starting point and a better foothold in things that they're going to, you know, see and learn about and may possibly identify with themselves, and just have a better understanding. Because when you read them in a book as a child, you have time to absorb it and think about it and feel it. And it kind of becomes a part of your person. Like, there's so many books that I read as a kid that there are lessons in there that I don't remember the book I read, but I definitely remember, you know, feeling for the character and experiencing things with them and, you know, all of that. So yeah, I think it's excellent. It's the world. Like, there's no reason not to give kids a chance to kind of see the whole world and not just how one person or another person wants you to see it.
Exactly. Exactly. One of the last parts about this that I want to talk about is basically a lot of characters kind of choosing either male or female visages, in that Mean's cousin chose to be male, despite the fact that most fox spirits choose to be female because he wanted to be more like June, who was male. And also Mean pretends to be Zhang for most of the story and thereby goes by he, him pronouns, pretends to be a boy. And not that that changes her, but I just find it really interesting that we have a lot of non-binary characters, but we also have other characters who choose their gender or choose to appear one way. And it's all very comfortable, and it's not really like a big deal for those sort of things.
Agreed. Yeah. The thing with Min's cousin, with him choosing to be male, I wondered if that was like it kind of made me wonder if maybe foxes are born non-binary, like they're kind of born one way and then they choose their human appearance. Cause like, they're a fox,
right?
Technically, you know what I mean? So it kind of made me wonder, like, you know, I wonder how that works for them and all of that. But yeah, it's not, you know, it's just part of the story and the world we're in.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It is cool. Okay. This is your official spoilers are incoming. If you don't want to hear any spoilers, skip forward to the chapter review section of the podcast, and we'll contain all the spoilers between now and then. So be gone, all Run you who don't want spoilers.
This is your last chance, in all caps. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So two major things I want to talk about, which is Captain Wan and June.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess first and foremost, did you guess that Captain Wan was the one who was behind everything?
At first, no. It wasn't until Mean broke into his quarters that I truly believed he had more to do, you know, he had everything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, I thought that maybe Juan was being used, like someone was making it look like he was the one behind things, because it kind of, I got that impression, but
right.
I thought maybe somebody was setting him up to take the fall or all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention, because of Daughter of the Deep, I had his brother evil.
Yeah.
Things going, you know, like I questioned whether June was going to end up having turned or something, like, you know, it had been a while since Mean had seen him. So I'm like, maybe something came about and he had to change sides for one reason or another. So I wasn't entirely sold until she went into his quarters and like read his notes and read his plans and all that. Mm-hmm. That was when I was like, okay, Juan is definitely a problem.
Yeah. I kind of suspected him, but I think the book did a good job of making you suspect multiple people. And yeah, even making you suspect June, because you have all of these people kind of talking about what they think they know about the situation. And Mina's trying to figure out what the actual truth is. And so there was a point in time where I was like, maybe June actually did do it. And like, maybe he has a good reason, but maybe he did do it of his own volition. But it turns out that it was the captain and everything was kind of set up to look that way. And I was slightly disappointed in that. I really liked Captain Juan in terms of like his strength and his respectability as a captain. And you wanted him to be a good guy, you know? But yeah. I also think that it was a really good kind of twist to the story that he ended up being the one behind it all. But I think the bigger twist was June actually did die. That really shocked me.
I didn't like it at all. I was so mad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I get it. I do. I get that. I didn't particularly love how he died.
Okay.
I wish that maybe June, like the fact that like the whole crew died basically in the crash, as opposed to having been killed by Juan or something, because he knew that they weren't going to actually do, you know, like if Juan turned on them and had them killed, or if the ghosts had gotten them and just overwhelmed them on their way to the Pearl or something like that. I, for some reason, them dying in the actual crash kind of made me a little upset.
I was definitely upset at first when we found out that her brother died, just because this whole story was her going off to save him, to bring him home. And him dying was so sad, especially because you have the previous experience with Zhang in terms of what it means to be a spirit and how they can bring bad luck and how they can be kind of tricky. And you're wondering how he's going to present himself. It turns out that he's still very much him. He still wants to help his sister. He still has some of his fox abilities. He's not going away. And I think that was the saving grace for me. If he had died and then he was like relegated to stay on that planet, or like he moved on, I think I would have been really disappointed. But because his unfinished business is wanting to see the world or the universe,
all 1,000 of them.
Yeah. Then, you know, he's sticking with Mean now. And that kind of saved it for me, because at least he's not going away. At least he still gets to be the big brother, just in a different form than we were maybe expecting.
I agree with you 100%, because thinking about it, if he had stayed alive, he's how much older than her? 2 years, I believe. I think he's 15 in the story.
Yeah, 15 or 16.
The chances of him and Mean being able to travel together would be slim.
Right.
He would always be on a different ship, or always be in a higher, at a higher level, or in a different place. And they're not going to put his sibling underneath him in a power structure. They, you know, most places don't do that in our workforce, you know, these days. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I feel like if June hadn't died, the chances of him and Mean being able to see the thousand worlds together would have been very slim. Like, maybe eventually, but it would have taken a while. So, yeah, I'm not happy June died, but at least this way, they get to stay together.
Yeah.
All the time. He's always there, and they get to experience everything side by side. And that is definitely the saving grace.
He's always there. Because he literally cannot go that far physically from her.
Yeah.
And that's gonna be a pain in the butt at some point in time.
when he was talking to her and was like, I can haunt you instead.
Yeah.
I honestly thought that he was going to end up haunting something, like an object that she carried or something, so that, not necessarily the pearl, but I really thought he was going to kind of tie himself to something that she could like take or
leave. She could set it down and walk away and be like, you can't follow me.
Well, just so that like in certain instances, if having a ghost would be detrimental,
mm-hmm.
she wouldn't be locked in, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that was my first impression. But I actually like that he's quote-unquote haunting her, because now, yes, they're absolutely linked, and nobody can take June from her. And I like that better, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely an interesting dynamic. And I wonder if, you know, how much they actually did think this through. But that being said, I love their sibling relationship. I think that it's really strong, even though they are two different personalities. Like, they still love each other. They respect each other. They trust each other. And that's something that I'm very excited to see develop in further books, basically.
Agreed. Definitely agree.
That's actually a really good segue into the Cursed Carnival and Other Calamities short story by Yoon Ha Lee, which is called The Initiation. And basically the reason why we had to discuss spoilers in this episode anyway is because The Initiation takes place after Dragon Pearl and before Tiger Honor. And Mean and June have to go to school to become real agents in the Space Forces. And they're still together. Like, that's the most exciting part for me, I think, is like we see them once again together, and she's still got her fox spirit abilities and everything, but now she's also being haunted by a ghost. She's a very complicated person to bring on board a ship, but
yeah.
Her powers and everything that she and June can do together, they'll make wonderful agents, not to even mention how intelligent and resourceful she is.
Right. And he has all of that knowledge with the Space Force and everything he's been through that, yeah, they're pretty formidable. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. So in this short story, we meet four new characters, and I'm going to run through them kind of quickly. Hansu is a human, goes by he, him, wants to be part of administration. Duri is a dragon, goes by they, them, wants to be a customs inspector. Chinsun is a goblin, she, her, computer technician. And Haru is a human, she, her, combat. I know that was a lot. I really, really loved Haru. With her guns and everything, I thought she was so funny and just a really good part of the dynamic. But it was really cool to see like another dragon again, another goblin, like more humans, and just how everybody sort of interacts with each other.
Mm-hmm. I think I was most, I don't know, amused by Chinsun.
Yeah.
just because, I don't know, there's something about, first of all, the name Chinsun like makes me smile. I don't know why. I don't actually know what the name means, but something about it. And like, and she's kind of cheeky, and like, because she's into like computers and wants, you know, is a great hacker and all of that. Mm-hmm. Like, I picture every female awesome hacker I've ever seen, which is, there's so many of them.
Yeah.
So many of them from movies and TV and things that I love. So, yeah, and they're all, like, cheeky, you know, don't take any crap from people kind of characters. So I don't know if I just find that to Jin Sun because of all that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Although I do love Dory too. So
they all had to go through different trials as well. Basically, as soon as you get on board the ship, they pretend that something goes wrong. And then all of a sudden you're thrown into the situation and you pass or fail. And I thought the kind of trial by fire aspect of Mean's first test was really interesting and kind of shows how resourceful and intelligent she is. So I thought like that aspect was really cool. And we get to hear everybody else's stories as well with like the, I think it was like killer robots and somebody had to find like a fake item. Mm-hmm. There was like a whole range of ways that they get tested when they come on board. And it was just like, I would read more stories like this. Like I would read their, each of their individual stories about the tests or a whole book about this sort of thing. Cause I thought it was really interesting.
And the only one we didn't get was Hansu, right? Hansu helps with means. And then they start to ask about it. Cause I think Hansu says it didn't go well. And then June, like, pokes Mean and is like, don't, like, leave him be.
Oh, okay.
And she kind of says, okay. And then she's like, I'll just ask somebody else later. Like, I'll talk to somebody else later. I'm sure they all know what happened. So I think Hansu is the only one we didn't get the story for, which I'm just curious if that means that maybe down the line we could get something about Hansu and maybe find out what happened.
I'll be interested to see if any of these characters come back in some capacity.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But the real meat of this story is that they then have to face a real threat where all of their magic goes haywire. And basically everyone finds out that Mina is a fox spirit accompanied by her ghost of a brother. And I thought that was really interesting because a huge theme of Dragon Pearl was the prejudice against fox spirits and honestly prejudice against ghosts as well. They're both kind of considered tricksters. One is considered bad luck and the people who believe foxes actually still exist don't trust them. And a lot of other ones just kind of know the old stories about them. And they're kind of shocked when they first find out that Mean is indeed a fox spirit. And this final kind of test that actually wasn't really a test was interesting. And they were forced to rely on each other, even though they don't really know each other that well. And again, like I could have read a fully fleshed out book about this group of characters. I thought they were really interesting and kind of jumped off the page.
Agreed. And I mean, I don't know what Yoon's plans are for future books in this, you know, not necessarily a series because he doesn't necessarily have to stick with telling Mean's story from here on out. But like, if they were interested in writing for one of these characters, maybe like taking Hansu's journey through school or something, like that would be really cool. So yeah, I don't know what the future holds for these four, but I would definitely read more from them for sure.
Yeah. Well, that wraps up Dragon Pearl and the initiation. We will be talking about Tiger Honor next week. Do you have any idea what goes on in Tiger Honor?
Currently, no.
You're just going to jump in blind.
I think so.
That's good. I think that's a good idea. Like I said, I really, really enjoyed reading them back to back. So I think it's a good idea for you to do the same because I'm right and you should listen to what I say. No, I'm just kidding. But I really liked basically going from one story to the other. I think it really enhanced my experience with Tiger Honor. So I hope you feel similarly to me, but no pressure.
No pressure at all. Got it.
So should we jump into our chapter reviews now?
I think that is an excellent idea. So this week we read chapters 7 and 8 of Sea of Monsters. Chapter 7's title is I Accept Gifts from a Stranger. Dishes, quests, and escape attempts, oh my. That's what Chapter 7 had in store for us. Percy and Annabeth get relegated to dish duty, which involves lava and a lot of danger. They use the time to chat and come to the conclusion that they need to help Grover get the Golden Fleece and save Camp Half-Blood. They just need to get Tantalus to let them go first. Tantalus is less than helpful when he assigns Clarice the task instead, but that doesn't stop our heroes. Percy sneaks out to have a Coke on the beach and finds himself chatting with Hermes. Hermes gifts Percy with a thermos full of the Earth's four winds, a bottle of potent multivitamins, and packs for him, Annabeth, and Tyson just a couple of emergency packs too. Annabeth and Tyson appear just as Hermes takes off. Oh, and there's a ship making its way across Long Island Sound that they may be able to catch if Poseidon is feeling helpful. This chapter was one of those where I don't necessarily think a lot happened, but they had to fit a lot of different scenes into the chapter. Yeah,
it was absolutely necessary to get from point A to point B. And a lot of it was transitionary, but at the same time, like, I found it all interesting. Like, I find Tantalus's presence at camp to be interesting, even if he is super annoying. I find, you know, the chat that Percy had with Hermes and everything Percy is feeling right now, especially when you throw like him and Annabeth, their fight and everything into the mix, like, and the issues with Tyson being around, like, a lot of it, it's just a lot for Percy. And so while not a whole lot happened, like, it was all still really important to kind of set them off on this quest.
Agreed. Definitely. Yeah. And speaking of Annabeth and Percy, they kind of find their way through their fight pretty easily. All it takes is gift duty.
Apparently. Yeah. And a mutual person to be angry at.
Yeah.
They have a common enemy. I love that this was like, we always take notes for the podcast and then we kind of just go through it and each of us jumps in when we find the appropriate opening. And this was number one on both of our lists. We're like, we love that, you know, Annabeth and Percy came back together because now they have somebody to hate.
Pretty much. Yep. Yep. And they've got a problem to solve, which is another thing that they work well. Like, when there's a quest looming or something that they have to fix, like, they work together well. It's just not always when it comes to things like chariot making.
Yeah, for sure.
We should probably talk about Tantalus, because after Percy and Annabeth do the dishes, they go to like the campfire or whatever. And they're doing their normal campfire activities, and they've decided that the best place to ask Tantalus about this quest and like ask for permission to go on a quest is at this campfire in front of everybody, where they'll be, the peer pressure will hopefully push him to let them do it. And it almost works. It almost works. Like, we definitely feel the pressure from everybody else, but Tantalus is, you know, one step ahead, as any good camp leader would be, and he gives Clarice the quest instead.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't like Tantalus. You're not supposed to like Tantalus.
Yeah.
But his presence at camp does make things really interesting. And all things considered, it does kind of make sense to give Clarice the quest, because she did win the chariot race. Like, I understand his line of thinking, even though he was just trying to be mean to Percy. And, you know, Percy and Annabeth and them, they're the ones with the information. They should be going. But I was surprised by how much I saw his point of view when it came to giving the quest to Clarice.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely doing it to needle Percy. Clarice does have a claim on it, but I think Percy and Annabeth's, affection for Grover should have maybe given them first billing, mostly because Grover is like one of the reasons that the quest would exist.
Right.
Like, it's to save Grover.
I think where I'm kind of coming from here is not that Annabeth and Percy aren't amazing fighters in and of themselves, but you do want to send your strongest warrior. And since she just won the chariot races.
Yeah.
You know, that, like, it was surprising to me how much it made sense to pick Clarice and how much I was like, yeah, I get that. But also, like, no, Percy and Annabeth and Tyson, they're going to end up going on this either way.
Yeah. The only other thing about Tantalus was, he made like a very scary little speech at the campfire as a way to like antagonize everyone and basically like intimidate them and all that. I did not remember that at all. And, like, I was trying to figure out who it was, but I wasn't, like, taking extra time to figure it out. Cause I was like, I know it's not important. Like, let's keep moving right now. But do you remember who that is?
You're talking about his speech when he talks about like feeding children to the gods. That's Tantalus's story.
Okay. That's what I thought. Okay. Yeah. I couldn't remember if that was leading to something else down the line or if that was his story and he was like just trying to scare them.
He was basically like, just remember, this is who you're dealing with. And I think like most of the campers got the message. And even if they didn't necessarily know that story, like you're right. It was still a really scary story.
Well, like about halfway through, like he started saying like there's someone at this camp with that power. And I couldn't remember if he was just being like obtuse and doing it on purpose. Like, oh, I wonder who it is. Or if he truly didn't know and was hoping to like make them an ally. I couldn't remember exactly the details of his story at that point. So yeah. I'm glad to know that. So in case anyone else was confused.
And it also makes sense why his punishment is that he's not allowed to eat or drink anything, considering he tried to feed his children to the gods.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Okay. So that, you know, smooth sailing, made it through that. Okay. Good news. After all of that happens and, you know, Percy and Annabeth find out that Clarice is getting the quest and she's going to go see the Oracle, everybody goes to bed and Percy decides he can't just sit in his cabin. Like he's not sleeping. So whatever. He grabs a 6-pack of Coke and goes to the beach to sit down and just like take a second. And I love that like a Coke calms his brain.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wonder if that's like a proven thing. Like,
it's because he has ADHD.
Right. And I just wonder if like the caffeine or the sugar has some sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot. Like,
I didn't know that. So I thought it was interesting.
A lot of medications and drugs have different effects on people with ADHD. I don't understand the science of it or anything, but yeah, it's definitely a thing. And I obviously, this is such a tiny detail, like I didn't remember this from when I first read it, but I read it and I kind of had a similar reaction to you. I was like, this is so interesting that he put it in there. It's such a small detail, but it goes to show that Rick really understands what a brain with ADHD is like.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cause like, I know caffeine is an ingredient in a lot of like migraine medicines and things. Mm. So I know it does have specific properties for like calming the brain, like it does, but I didn't know for sure if like that was a thing or whether it was just like Percy likes a Coke and it helps him relax, so you know. But that's cool. Like, I just thought that was a really fun, interesting little thing to put in there.
My thing about the Coke is apparently if you pay the right kid in the Hermes cabin, you can get contraband Coke. But what I'm wondering is, where do these children get the gold drachmas? Like, do they have jobs? Do they earn it from camp? Do their parents like trade in human money for gold drachmas and give them allowance for the summer? Like, I know this is so unimportant, but I want to know the economics of Camp Half-Blood and how, like, because they just tend to, like, sometimes the gods give them drachmas, like Hermes gives Percy and them drachmas for the trip, but he already had drachmas on him. Where did he get those in order to get the contraband Coke?
That is a really good point. Like, I kind of thought the same thing, but not to the extent you did. Like, it was just kind of like, you know, oh, like they just use drachmas. Like, okay. You know, we know that they're useful for other things that we get to later in this book and other books. But yeah, like it does seem a bit unexplained. Does regular money turn into drachmas when you walk into Camp Half-Blood? Like, do you take a $50 bill across the, you know, across the camp border and it instantly dissolves into a pile of gold coins? Or, you know, because I honestly couldn't tell you the exchange rate for a gold drachma. I have no idea how many you'd get for 50 bucks.
We know that the drachmas also work in the mortal world, like outside of camp. So it wouldn't change back if that were the case. So
that's true.
That's interesting. Like, this is such an unimportant question, but now I really need to know how that works.
Is there like a treasure trove of them in the forest, or do they pop up out of rocks or something? Like, I need to know where the Brockmas come from.
We've been playing too many video games where you like dig for resources
or hit things to get to get resources. Yep, for sure. For sure. Yeah, that's a thing. Okay. We get a sit down with Hermes in this chapter.
Yeah. Which is the first time we're meeting him.
Yeah. And he's very, I would say, approachable in this chapter. He seems
like a cool guy.
Yeah. He comes up to Percy and he doesn't necessarily identify himself right away. Mm-hmm. He starts talking to him and Percy's kind of trying to put the pieces together. Like, who is this dude? And then he pulls out a cell phone with a couple of creatures. I don't even know what they look like on the cell phone. Well, but I couldn't remember if they looked like snakes on the phone.
I think probably. They did.
But they're like intertwined and just kind of like wrapping themselves around the phone. And then he starts talking about Eris and all this other stuff. And you can tell Percy's like, okay.
That part really made me laugh because he basically says Eris is in customer service. Eris is the goddess of discord. So she is causing all sorts of problems. So it makes so much sense that she's in customer service. And it's one of those lines where, like, if you don't really know Greek mythology, you can kind of just run through it. Like, maybe you get the gist of it, but it's not like a big deal. But if you know a lot of the stories and you know who a lot of the people are, like, this is really, really funny. And I love that it's not just like he sprinkles this like tiny stuff throughout the books. And it's like seeing a reference. It's like seeing an Easter egg in a Marvel movie. Like, you're like, oh, I understand what that means. And it just makes you happy. This is how I felt when I read that line.
It just adds a little something extra.
Yeah.
Just a little extra thing. Doesn't a little take cherry you, on top.
Doesn't take you out of the moment if you don't understand it, but it really adds to it if you do.
I thought it was just a clue that Hermes was not a human because Percy was busy asking himself, like, is this a jogger who just walked through the border because the border's acting up? Like, is this guy just a human and I'm about to have a convo with him? Like, what's going on? And then you get this like Eris, you know, mention, and then you start to kind of get clues that this is not a normal human. Like, this is probably a Greek in some, you know, whether it's a god or another demigod or, you know, a spirit or something. It's definitely somebody involved in Camp Half-Blood. So yeah.
Right. Overall, I will say that I did like Hermes a lot. I thought that he was interesting, probably one of the nicer gods. Also, he invented the internet. So thank you, Hermes. We definitely appreciate that.
For sure. I'm very appreciative of the internet. This podcast would not exist without the internet.
That is true.
So thanks, Hermes.
We would just be talking to ourselves.
Yeah, and we already talked about what he gave Percy, but I'm just going to run through it really quick again so that we all remember, because it's going to come in handy. He gives him a thermos that is full of the four winds, and he warns him not to open it all the way at first, which is probably smart. A bottle of what are described as multivitamins, which cracked me up, and the different shapes are apparently different. Like strengths or something.
Yeah, wasn't it like the Minotaur, the Furies?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they had like different flavors or something. Yeah, it was really quite
basically
funny.
Like Flintstone
vitamins,
but for the Greek gods.
With Greek monsters. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he also gave him three waterproof packs, one for Annabeth, one for Tyson, and one for Percy. With all the essentials, and we get into the essentials in the next chapter. So
Another like really quick aside is that I always really liked these moments and stories. And when I was a very young, very bad writer, I would take a lot of time to describe exactly everything that would like fit into the backpack that the, you know, main character took to go on their quest. And, you know, there's definitely a place for it. And I think this totally works, like knowing what they have and everything. But it reminds me a lot of like video games and stuff, like survival video games, where you need to make sure you have all the essentials with you and you have to balance what you actually put in there, what you have room for. And I just like, it's little things like this that just make me happy. And I think like really add to the story. And I was going to say a non-essential way. I think some of this stuff will be really essential, especially the thermos full of wind, but just knowing that they have everything they need makes sense to me and doesn't make you wonder, okay, well, you know, how are they going to get a change of clothes? Or like, are they going to brush their teeth? Or, you know, these things that you tend to think of when you live in a world as deeply as this one.
I agree. Because the only other option Rick could have really done is that Annabeth and Tyson, who are walking up on the scene right now, if they had packed for them, mm-hmm. like for themselves, and maybe Annabeth helped Tyson, they would have had to have packed for Percy, which I guess could have worked, but it makes so much more sense that Hermes is just like, here's what you need. Yeah. And it's waterproof. Go for it. Have a good quest,
basically. And was gentleman enough to grab Annabeth's invisibility hat and yes. Tyson's bag of wonder.
Tools.
Yeah.
Yeah. His little tools project. And his project. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, Hermes definitely thought it out and grabbed what they needed of their own things and made sure that they had, you know, the other things with them that were going to be necessary. So, and that ends the chapter there. They're basically, Percy's waiting on the other two to walk up and to figure out what their ride is going to be to this giant ship that's just making its way across Long Island Sound. So let's jump into, should we do favorite moments first?
Sure. Switch.
Karen, do you want to do yours?
Yeah. it's basically when Percy shames Tantalus into giving out a quest. I love that he knew Tantalus wouldn't give it to him regardless, pretty much. But he was like, there's no way if we go up to him by ourselves that he's going to let us do this. But if we do it in front of the whole camp and people think that there's a chance that we could save the camp, he has to say yes. And he does, but he gives it to Clarice. But I just love that Percy, you know, we always talk about Annabeth being the smart one, the one with the battle strategy, but Percy has a lot of really good ideas too. And this was a really good moment for him.
Definitely. Yeah. I quite love watching him kind of pull one over on Tantalus, like, yeah. Haha, now you have to give out a quest, and it, you know, he finds a way to poke Percy with it. But, you know, at the same time, it still wasn't on Tantalus's to-do list. Let's put it that way. My favorite moment was Percy's discussion with Hermes, mostly because I just love seeing Percy taking some time for himself on the beach near the water. Like, he didn't really have any real reason to be there other than to take a moment to himself. And Hermes shows up, and pretty soon Percy's life is, you know, going full speed ahead again.
Mm-hmm.
So having be able to take a moment was really nice.
That's a good way to describe it, considering Hermes is the god of like travel, and he's always depicted going really fast and stuff. Like, it is full speed ahead once you meet Hermes.
Yep, pretty much. Yeah. All right. And let's do our favorite quotes too. Karen, do you want to go first?
This is when Annabeth is talking about, oh gosh, what part was this? She was
describing where the fleece came from.
Yeah.
The story of the Golden Fleece. Yeah.
And basically Annabeth says, Europa fell off and died along the way, but that's not important. And Percy just goes, it was probably important to her. And I laughed.
And it kind of surprised me that Annabeth took that take on it. Like,
yeah.
Wouldn't Annabeth feel that Europa should be counted? But apparently not.
Yeah. I guess, like, sometimes these myths feel like they're so far in the past, even for the demigods, because everything that they know is based off of these things that happened in ancient Greece, even if they are more relevant to, like, you and I as mere mortals. But it is funny to think about how history is for the demigods, because Greek mythology is very much in the present, but it's also in the ancient past.
So crazy. Yeah. And my favorite quote is kind of an exchange. It happened with both of my quotes this week because I can't just pick a single line. It doesn't make sense. Anyway, mine starts with Annabeth, who says, you do know the story of Jason and the Argonauts. Percy. Yeah, I said that old movie with the clay skeletons. Annabeth rolls her eyes. Oh my gods, Percy, you're so hopeless. Like, I love them so much. Like, yeah. the Percy has a general idea, but his references are dated and not what Annabeth trusts. You know, she's read it in the original Greek and is, you know, making sure she understands the nuances. And Percy's just like, oh, yeah, I get the gist.
This feels very Rick to me, by the way, because I think he's talked in the past about liking the old movies, like growing up on them, and that being one of the reasons why he fell in love with Greek mythology to begin with. So like, this just felt like Rick speaking here, and I liked that a lot.
Yeah, which is cute. I like that. Okay, so that wraps up chapter 7. And now we're going to talk about chapter 8, We Board the Princess Andromeda, which I will just say right now is not, it's very short. Yes. And there's not a whole lot going on.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a quick discussion. But let's start with a brief recap. Poseidon provides some sea ponies, or hippocampi, to transport the trio to the cruise ship. They speed across the water like jet skis upon their steeds, and Tyson names his Rainbow. They board the ship with goodbyes to Rainbow and quickly realize that something is off. A decent night's sleep, complete with Grover Dream later, and the trio realize that Luke is aboard the ship, and it's filled with humans in a trance. Oh, and did we mention the monsters, too? Let's talk about the hippocampi.
Yes, Rainbow.
I love them so much.
Me too. They're some of my favorite creatures. And it's one of the things that I specifically remember prior to the Sea of Monsters movie coming out, like seeing the sketches for them and how they were going to bring them to life and really, really loving it. So this is something else that I'm looking forward to with the TV show, if we're lucky enough to get a season 2, is like what they're going to look like on screen. Because they sound like such beautiful creatures.
Yeah, they're half horse and half like fish or water creature. It was hard to see how they described the second half of them. They were flying through the water, so they can swim, and they have a tail basically. But yeah, like they're rainbow, and that just makes me really happy. And yeah, it's just I love the hippocampi.
Yeah. They're so cute.
And I love Tyson's affection for them.
I know.
He knows what they are because he works in the forges.
Mm-hmm.
They're underwater. And so he's well acquainted with the hippocampi, right?
Well, I was just going to say, is that yet? Because he was living on the streets, but he does mention having been taken care of before.
Well, because when Beckendorf takes him to the forges, he already knows what to do.
Is that his, like, natural ability?
See, I think I just assumed that until Percy needed a protector and needed someone in the real world, Tyson was under the water.
I don't know. I'm not sure about that, actually.
Maybe that was my mistake. Especially because he recognized them. It was like, fish ponies! Like, he didn't stumble across it at all. It was like he recognized them.
I wonder if that was just him being excited, like they're fish ponies. Yeah, that's a good question, because I'm definitely like, I know he's worked underwater in the forges. I'm pretty sure that comes later on, but right now we're still like, Percy is still very unclear about where Tyson came from, what he's been doing all these years, like if he was abandoned by Poseidon or if something else was going on. So we might just not have that answer yet. We'll have to keep that in mind and come back to it later.
Prior to him, you know, becoming the homeless person in the alley that befriended Percy, I think I kind of just assumed that he had spent time down there, but you're right. Like, we're not quite there in the story yet. Like, later on in the story, we know that he spends time there, but yeah. So we'll have to keep our eyes peeled and see if we get more details about that coming up.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I do love Tyson's reaction to the fish ponies, though. It makes me
very happy. I agree. He's adorable.
And he names one Rainbow.
Yes. It's a good name.
And he doesn't want to leave Rainbow.
Yeah, and Rainbow doesn't want to leave either.
Rainbow can't climb the ladder, though, so, you know, we're out of luck. Sorry. I think we should probably take a second to talk about Grover and the prophecy.
Yep, prophecy count number 8.
Yep, we are officially at number 8. And this one shows us Grover in his little I don't even, in his quarters, basically, wherever he...
Back of the cave.
Right? Like, it's in his section of the cave or whatever. Yeah. And he's frantically unwinding what he's already done to finish the train on his wedding dress, so that he can show his captor that it's not done yet, and I've made progress, but not enough, and we can't get married yet. So the most important part of this, I think, is us learning that Grover has bought himself 7 days.
Yeah. It was supposed to be 10, then it dropped to 5, and then he convinced Polyphemus that 7 was less than 5.
Yes. So we have 7 days to get Percy and Annabeth there and to save Grover from his fate. So that's probably the most important part of the whole dream. But Percy also does have a vision of Tartarus. I don't remember anything more about it, like just basically that he's at the foot of the pit and then something happens, but he transitions very quickly to Grover.
Yeah, I think Kronos basically is just talking to him, essentially, yeah. But not a whole lot goes on there.
Like just reminding him that, like, I'm still here. Yeah. Still up to no good, in case you forgot. But yeah, so that's good to know. We've got 7 days. We need a countdown. When you're on a quest, you need an end date. So
you need a timeline.
Yep. And we're not going to get an official one from a prophecy. So this will take one from this kind of prophecy instead.
Right.
And the only other note I really made for this chapter was that Annabeth is even more determined than Percy to bring Luke to justice. Because after they get onto the Andromeda, they do like a quick tour and they see that no one is really there. Like they don't find anybody. So they kind of take up a stateroom upstairs and they go to bed and they wake up the next day and find a whole bunch of people in humans in a trance. And they don't seem to be making much sense, but they believe themselves. And then they stumble across a monster or two and they're still just like, what's going on? They hide in a girl's bathroom and then they hear Luke.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the chapter ends. And I was like, ah, you know, like, how could you not flip to the next page when you're reading that?
Right. Yeah. Because Annabeth basically, you know, they were determined to get off the ship and they were saying, we don't need to deal with this. Like, let's just bail. And Annabeth hears Luke's voice and is like, nope, change of plans. We're not going anywhere. We have to figure out what he's up to, because if I get a chance, I'm going to wrap him in chains and drag him to Mount Olympus. Let's go.
Yeah.
And that's where the chapter ends. So let's do favorite moments again. Karen, do you want to do yours first again?
Yeah, mine was the Hellhound eating the scrambled eggs and basically no one saying anything about it. I know that Hellhounds are meant to be creepy and scary. It's described as like a large mastiff, which I love big dogs and I love mastiffs. So it's very hard not to see it as a giant puppy. But I enjoyed the image of it just like paws on the table eating scrambled eggs and everybody else kind of just waiting in line behind it till it's done.
I think I usually think of the Hellhounds as, yeah, like really cute big mastiffs, but that like have lava boiling under their skin. Mm. Like, yeah, that's, I think I always kind of picture like them kind of glowing a little bit because of the fire that's associated with them or whatever. So, yeah, but I liked that part, too. It's just funny and cute. Everything we love about Rick. Mine was Tyson wanting to bring Rainbow Alarm along. It's just the hippocampi. I can't help myself. What was your favorite quote?
Mine was kind of the inner monologue that Percy is having. He says, that's why my mom named me after him, even though he was a son of Zeus and I was a son of Poseidon. The original Perseus was one of the only heroes in the Greek myths who got a happy ending. This is one of the lines that has stuck with me all of these years, because I never really realized that. I mean, a lot of heroes get tragic endings. A lot of times you just hear about these heroes fighting these horrible monsters and some of them succumbing to a horrible death. And I never really realized that Perseus was one of the ones that had the happier ending. And I just love Sally's reason for naming Percy after him.
Yeah. I mean, that is, especially because of the Zeus Poseidon connection. Like, it is right. kind of flummoxing. Like, why would she name him after one of Zeus's kids? But she has a very good reason. Go Sally. Sally's awesome all the time. My favorite quote is another exchange because I'm me. And it's between Percy and Annabeth. And Percy says, Dad, how's it going? And Annabeth says, Percy, we're in a hurry. And Percy goes, we need your help. We need to get to that ship, like, before we get eaten and stuff. So, and it's just, there's something about their interplay that makes me smile.
I really appreciated that he didn't want to just ask his dad for something, like, straight off the bat. Like, he wanted to be like, hey, how you doing? Like, you know, that small talk before you ask somebody for a yeah. favor. Like, he felt like he needed to do that. And I think it's, like, the kind part of him that didn't want to be rude. So, but yeah. Annabeth also had a good point that they didn't really have time to spare.
I really just wanted to do the, we need to get to that ship, like, before we get eaten and stuff. But I feel yeah. like to get the whole point of that, you need the whole thing.
Yeah.
You need the whole
interaction. And if I'm remembering correctly from Rewatchable, you also tend to choose exchanges between characters for favorite quotes, which is where we stole this from, by the way. Yeah. So I remember you always doing, like, exchanges between people. So at least you're consistent.
Yeah. It's one of my quirks, part of my charm. Okay. So yeah, that now wraps us up. And next week we will be back with chapters 9 and 10. So make sure to read those and we will check in with you in our next episode. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at subjectifymedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast, or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can email us your long-form thoughts at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms to listen. Please consider giving us a review or a 5-star rating. Would be really great. It helps other people find us, so that's always really wonderful. You can leave us questions and comments in any of these places or ideas for content that you want to see or hear us discuss. We did get some feedback this week. Karen, do you want to take our email?
I do. I was so happy when this came through. So this is from Henry. And let me just say, it made us both so happy. Okay, so this is just a snippet from the email, but Henry says, the fact that 2 grown-ups can get together and make something like this just to have conversations about this leaves me speechless. It is so terrific to see that even adults continue to be touched by Rick Riordan's works. The creativity on this podcast is amazing, and the kinds of things you guys come up with to talk about keeps me thoroughly entertained. The Prophecy Radio podcast is filled with so much life, humor, and fun, and I love the energy you guys bring to it. I just discovered your podcast this week and immediately caught myself up on all 14 episodes. Let me tell you, that was probably a lot of hours. Yeah. I look forward to listening for more content from you. Please keep making more. I was also very shocked that not many people know about the podcast and that it has so few followers. I will do what I can to promote it where I can. This just made my entire day, my entire week. I was so happy to see this come through, not only because it's just another adult being like, hey, I appreciate that you still love Rick Riordan. I like what you're doing. Thank you for doing it. Like, we did this for fun because we wanted to. You know, we're not really getting anything out of this outside of we just love Rick Riordan so much and wanted to, like, keep talking about this universe and everything that goes with it. But it feels really good to see somebody respond like this. And we are still a new podcast, so our, you know, follower count is fairly low, which I'm happy with the amount of followers that we're gaining. Like, every single person that gets added to, like, our Twitter account makes me happy. But I appreciate you, Henry, for saying that you will tell everybody about us, because I think that we're doing something really fun here that I hope connects with other people. And I'm not going to be mad if we make more Percy Jackson friends.
This is 100% co-signed by Kristen. Everything Karen just said is exactly, yeah. It was very, very nice of you to take the time to write to us. And we really loved all of your email, including the section that Karen read.
Yeah. And I really like reading the long form emails. I just think it's cool.
It's very nice. It's akin to letter writing. It really is.
Yeah.
Like, we're so used to tweets and, you know, a quick post here and there or a TikTok or whatever. But it's nice to get an email where it's got some space to kind of really talk about how you feel about something. So we really, really, really appreciate it. Okay. And the other bit of feedback that we wanted to talk about was this Percy Jackson chapter titles thing. Karen started it, so I'll let you set us up here.
Yeah, this was something, not necessarily feedback, but it was something we did on Twitter that got a couple of responses. So I thought it would be fun to at least say on the podcast. So you can go to our Twitter to see it if you want to see your own. But basically, there was this like meme going around from, it was from May 27th, 2020. So somebody must have like retweeted it recently. At Troubled Demigods tweeted this. And it was basically create your own Percy Jackson chapter title. And you put in your first letter of your first name, the first letter of your last name, your birthday month, and then your favorite color to build a chapter title for yourself. And mine, it was, I mysteriously ask a centaur in the labyrinth, which was like unfinished and ominous and vague, but I kind of liked it.
Yeah.
And then I did Kristen's. I did not ask for permission. I just did it anyway.
I think I did mine before you did it.
Really?
And I was like, I need to do that like when I have time to actually post it. But I think I like ran through it when I saw yours and was like, mine is blank. And then like mine showed up on the account like moments later. Yeah. And I was like, okay, Karen took care of it. Got it.
Do you want to tell everybody which one yours is?
Sure. Mine is I mysteriously bake with my teacher at Camp Jupiter.
Yours sounds so pleasant.
I mean, it's mysterious, but baking mysteriously is a thing.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Definitely. I mean, if you're having mysterious bakes, like who knows what you could be getting into. So
it's true. Lots.
But you're at Camp Jupiter. That's fun.
Right? Sounds like fun. Sure.
Yeah. So we got a couple of people who responded to this. First up is Phoebe at Green Schwerp, who says, mine is, I kindly hide from a centaur in the labyrinth. And then they also say, can you ask it to leave me alone? And I told them that we had a bunker that we would keep them safe in. So we'll have to make room. But yeah. And then we also got a tweet from Keyboard Warrior at Aaron LG43. I accidentally fight my teacher. And then they said, I really am a son of Poseidon then. And that made me laugh.
That's actually, yeah, that sounds like a Percy title. It really does. Because that's
really
a thing Percy would and has done.
And has done. Definitely has done.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so that wraps up our episode. Next time, we will be talking about Tiger Honors. So if you have already read Dragon Pearl, especially for this podcast, if you wanted to listen, feel free to keep listening on next time once you read Tiger Honor, because we may get into some spoilers again. Just be ready for it. But yeah, we'll be talking about Tiger Hunter next week, as well as chapters 9 and 10 of Percy Jackson and the Sea of Monsters. So until next time, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.